Habakkuk, Part 1. The first talk on the Book of Habakkuk was presented by Peter Wieringa on June 25, 2006, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of this talk.
One of those Old Testament books that has profoundly influenced a lot of New Testament writers as they have recorded things. There's one verse out of Habakkuk that will be familiar to all of us. The righteous man shall live by faith. That verse is quoted by Paul in Romans. It's quoted by Paul in Galatians. It's quoted in Hebrews. And that verse has inspired and helped to shape so much of the New Testament writers' understanding of the truths that were expressed in the Old Testament. And so over the years, I've looked at Habakkuk several times. I found it to be just a fascinating, fascinating book. And this morning, what we're going to do is have sort of a two-part lesson. We're going to have a one-part, first half of the session is going to be sort of a history lesson, kind of a recap of parts of Old Testament history, parts of what went on during the later stages of the writing of the Old Testament. And then we're going to move into looking at the actual content of the book of Habakkuk and what Habakkuk had to say. Habakkuk is so interesting because it expresses in so many ways, so many different parts of the book, it expresses so clearly an understanding of human nature, an understanding of the way mankind functions left on his own, and it expresses so clearly also God's response to that, the way God views that. And it expresses all of that in a historical context of what actually happened in the life of the nation of Judah in the Old Testament. Well, let me start off by just giving you some historical background. How many of you folks are real familiar with the Old Testament? I always like to go back and sort of recap some of the history of the Old Testament in order to put some of these accounts in context. Again, this is one of the minor prophets. If you're looking for Habakkuk, you've had time to either look in the table of contents in your Bible to find him, or if you haven't found him yet, you can go to Matthew, turn left for four books, and you'll find Habakkuk there. So if you haven't found Habakkuk yet, that's where you'll find him. He's one of the one of what is known as the minor prophets, and he writes at a time in the nation of Judah, in the life of the Jews. He writes at a very critical time. And again, just a little bit of background, and I'm going to jump sort of into the middle of the history of the nation of Israel. I jump in at Solomon's life, because all of us have kind of a general idea of what happened prior to Solomon. You've got the forefathers in the book of Genesis. You've got the captivity in Egypt. You've got the freedom from Egypt from Exodus on, the accounts of Moses. You move on to an account of the judges, and then you get into the kings. And for most of us, if you're like me, for most of us, we get to Saul. We got him pegged. We know a little bit about Saul, when he lived, what he was doing. Then we've got David. David we've got figured out. He wrote the Psalms, a lot about David in the Old Testament. Then we get Solomon. We're fine there. And then after Solomon, it all kind of becomes a blur. At least if you're like me, that's what happens. Well, after Solomon, after he passed away, the throne was passed to his son Rehoboam. This is somewhere in the 900s. Solomon lived roughly in the middle of the 10th century B.C., 970 to 930, somewhere in there was about the time that Solomon lived. And after he passed away, his son Rehoboam came to the throne, and Rehoboam was a jerk. Rehoboam was not a good king. And so Rehoboam began to do some things that alienated most of the rest of the nation. And at that point, the 10 northern tribes peeled off following Jeroboam. The 10 northern tribes peeled off and became the nation of Israel, and the southern tribes became known as the nation of Judah. Just two tribes. 10 tribes peeled off to the north, became the nation of Israel, and then Judah remained in the south. Well, that went on in the Old Testament accounts in 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, talk about what went on in the nations of Israel and the nations of Judah for those couple of hundred years. And then you get to the mid-8th century B.C., somewhere in the 8th century, the northern tribes were dispersed. They were conquered by the Assyrians, and they were dispersed. And we don't have a real good feel, a real good historical account of exactly what happened to them. Later on, back in Jesus' time, the Samaritans were sort of half-Jews. That's the way they were viewed. They were, in some sense, descendants of some of the folks who had lived in Samaria at the time. But exactly what happened with the Jews who were part of the northern 10 tribes, the nation of Israel, isn't real clear. Well, that was in the mid-8th century B.C. Where we're going to pick up now is another 100, a little bit over 100 years later. And again, just in the historical context, what we have at that time in the 7th century, the mid-7th century B.C., the 600s, what we have is Assyria is the predominant power in the world at that time, more powerful even than Egypt. When we think about the accounts in Genesis, we think of Egypt being the leading world power at that time. Well, at this point in the mid-600s, Assyria is the predominant power. And if you look in your Bible, if you go to the map in the back, you can get a feel for just how to place this in a geographical context. Assyria, the Assyrians were to the east of the nation of Judah. They were to the east of what is now the nation of Israel. The Assyrians primarily inhabited the area now known as Iraq. In this account in Habakkuk, we're going to be talking about the Chaldeans. And just to let you know who they are, Well, we remember from the Genesis account, we remember the story of Abram coming from Ur of the Chaldees. The Chaldeans were primarily centered right around the northern, northwestern part of the Persian Gulf. So look at your maps in the back of your Bibles there. Look for the Persian Gulf, and you look north and to the west a little bit, and you'll find where the Chaldeans live. Now, the Chaldeans were sort of a minor tribe. When the Assyrians were in the ascendancy, the Chaldeans were a part of the Assyrian Empire, but they were not a major force in the Assyrian Empire at that time. But around, and you know, the dates you're going to, there's a little bit of give in the historical accounts by a year or two, around 626, Ashurbanipal, write that one down. Ashurbanipal was the ruler of Assyria. He died around 626 B.C., and at that point, there was some confusion as to who was going to follow Ashurbanipal, and the Assyrian Empire, as it was known at that time, began to weaken. That was a time that Egypt, as we'll talk about in a minute, Egypt decided to take their chances in trying to conquer the Assyrians. But when Ashurbanipal passed away, there wasn't anyone who was clearly ready to take his place, and it was at that point that the Chaldeans began to move in and exercise control over, authority over what had been the Assyrian Empire. And that's why, when the Chaldeans moved in, that's why the Chaldeans are referred to here. It's much the same empire as the Assyrian Empire, but now rather than Ashurbanipal being the king, he was replaced by, here's another good one, Nabopolassar. That's a good name. Try that one on with your son sometime. Nabopolassar came along. He was the Chaldean who came and began to take over ruling what had been the Assyrian Empire, and it became known as the Chaldean Empire at that time. At least, I mean, it's still Assyrian largely. And then Nabopolassar's son was Nebuchadnezzar, and he's one that we're all familiar with. He's a famous character in the biblical accounts. So That gives you a little bit of historical context. Back to the time frames, at the very time that the Assyrian Empire began to decline, like I said, the Egyptian Empire decided that they would take their chances. And again, if you look at your maps in the back of your Old Testament, and if you follow the Euphrates River, the way it worked out geographically is there wasn't a lot of activity. If you went from the northern part of the Persian Gulf straight across to Judah, that was not a route that people traveled. That was not a route. That was a very hostile geographical area, very hostile territory. That was not a route that world trade followed or anything at that time. So most of the activity that went on happened going up the Euphrates River, north and west of the Persian Gulf, up the Euphrates River until it got to sort of the northeast part of the Mediterranean Sea, and then it would follow down the coast road along the Mediterranean. Well, if you look in your maps there, you'll find that if that's where the world's activity was happening, and if that's where battles were going to be fought over world conquest, you'll find that the nation of Judah is in the way. There's no way to put it other than that. The nation of Judah was not a major world power at that time. There was a lot of significance to it. Jerusalem was a major commercial center, and because of its placement along the way, there was a lot of significance to the nation of Judah. But in terms of being a major player in world politics, they weren't at that time. So you have the Assyrians, the Chaldeans, who are coming up the Euphrates River, and you have the Egyptians who are coming up from Egypt and the south up through Judah, and that's right at the point where those forces meet. So again, the historical context, right about the time that the Assyrian Empire is declining, that Nabopolassar is coming in with the Chaldeans. In Judah, we have Josiah, who is king of Judah at that time. And if you remember the accounts of Josiah, very interesting Old Testament character. Josiah was the one who was made king when he was 8 years old, came to the throne at a very young age, and within a few years of his becoming king, he himself instituted major sweeping religious reforms in Judah. He recognized that his grandfather, Manasseh, had been a horrible ruler. He recognized the corruption, the idolatry, the terrible things that were going on when his grandfather Manasseh was the king, and he instituted fairly sweeping reforms that spread throughout the society in Judah at that time. Well, historians have different accounts about what happened. Some suggest that he became a little bit, Josiah became a little bit overconfident, perhaps. We don't know exactly what happened, but Josiah decided, right around 609, Josiah decided that he would go out and stand in the way of the Egyptian pharaoh, who was on his way up the Mediterranean to go down the Euphrates River to conquer Mesopotamia, to try and conquer the Assyrians. The Assyrians were weak. The Egyptian pharaoh Necho at the time, decided that he was going to make his move. And so as he's heading up the Mediterranean, there's Josiah with a relatively modest army from the nation of Judah that stands in his way. And at the battle at Megiddo in 609 BC, Josiah was killed in battle. So Josiah dies around 609. His son Jehoahaz comes to the throne. Jehoahaz is on the throne for a fairly short period of time before the Egyptian pharaoh removes Jehoahaz, brings him off to Egypt, where he ends up dying in Egypt, and the pharaoh installs Jehoiakim. I remembered all the names. That's incredible. The pharaoh installed Jehoiakim basically as the king of Judah at that time. Well, Jehoiakim, we're told, was just as bad as his great-grandfather Manasseh was. And there's actually a passage, I'm gonna read it to you here, that describes for you what went on in Manasseh's time, because the context that we're in is the rule of Jehoiakim, and Jehoiakim is characterized as being as bad as, perhaps even worse than, his great-grandfather Manasseh. Well, about Manasseh, it was said, this is in 2 Kings 23, starting in verse 27. This is what was written about Manasseh. And it says about Manasseh, it says, he did evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his fathers had done. And here's the description of his great-grandfather. That's about Jehoiakim, I'm sorry. And about his grandfather Manasseh in 2 Kings 20, starting in verse 21, it says, so Hezekiah slept with his fathers, and Manasseh his son became king in his place. Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Hephzibah. He did evil in the sight of the Lord, according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord dispossessed before the sons of Israel. For he rebuilt the high places, which Hezekiah his father had destroyed, and he erected altars for Baal, and he made an Asherah, as Ahab, king of Israel, had done. And he worshipped all the host of heaven and served them. He built altars in the house of the Lord. He made his son, jumping down to verse 6, he made his son to pass through the fire, practiced human sacrifice, is what that's saying. He made his son to pass through the fire. He practiced witchcraft. He used divination, and he dealt with mediums and spiritists. He did much evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger. Then he set the carved image of Asherah that he had made in the house of which the Lord said to David and his son Solomon, in this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen from all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever. And then down another verse it says, but the nation of Israel, the nation of Judah, but they did not listen. And Manasseh seduced them to do evil more than the nations whom the Lord destroyed before the sons of Israel. So to get the context there, Jehoiakim was as bad as his great-grandfather Manasseh. And as you can see from this account, Manasseh was a horrible king of Judah. Rather than encouraging the people to follow God, to pursue God, to understand the law, rather than encouraging them in that way, he rebuilt the high places. He built altars to all sorts of other gods. He practiced idolatry, witchcraft, spiritism, human sacrifice. He was a horrible king, so that of Manasseh it was said that he was even worse than the nations that had been dispossessed when the Jews came into the land. So that gives you some idea of the context that we're looking at there. The nation of Judah, the reforms of Josiah are a memory at that point. They're a thing of the past. And Jehoiakim is king, and he is doing terrible things in the nation of Judah. Well, 609 was when Josiah was killed. In 604, again, if you're looking at your map, in 604, Pharaoh Necho is on his way to try and conquer the Assyrians. They meet in battle at Carchemish, and if you're looking at your map, that is north and east a little ways of where Judah is located. They meet in battle at Carchemish, and Pharaoh Necho is soundly defeated by the Chaldeans at that point. That's in 604 BC. And the context of Habakkuk that we're going to jump into here in just a second, the context of Habakkuk is right at that time when there's tremendous geopolitical uncertainty. The Egyptians, the Assyrians are roaming back and forth through their territories or around their territories, trying to determine who is going to be the dominant world power at the time. And Judah is just sort of a bit player on the scene at that time. Well, that's the context into which Habakkuk is writing the book, and we see that when we look at the book itself and when we go through what Habakkuk has to say, we see some of that turmoil and some of that chaos reflected in Habakkuk's comments here. So turn to the book of Habakkuk, and we'll just start off. And what we're going to do, we're going to look at Habakkuk this week and next week both. So somewhere in the middle of this whole thing. We'll have sort of an abrupt end so that we can pick it up again this next week. But we're going to get through at least the first chapter and part of the second chapter before we quit for the day. The book of Habakkuk starts off saying, the oracle which Habakkuk the prophet saw, and he starts off with these words that this is why the book grips me so much, because Habakkuk's observations, God's comments, this whole account speaks so plainly, so clearly in my mind to the human condition. And this first verse here, this first comment that Habakkuk makes in verse 2 is such a poignant cry for help from Habakkuk. When he says to God, he says, how long, O Lord, will I call for help and you will not hear? I cry out to you violence and yet you do not save. That sets the stage for us for the book of Habakkuk, and I would suggest that that speaks to the basic human condition, where if we believe that God exists, then we have got to look around at the injustice in the world. We've got to look around at the chaos around us, perhaps the things going on in our own lives, the upheaval in our own lives. We've got to look at those things and ask that same question. How long, O Lord, will I cry out to you and you don't even seem to hear me? You don't seem to be listening. Now, I should tell you that we don't get a clear answer to that. And I think that is actually part of the answer. I think that's probably the big part of the answer when that question is raised. Habakkuk raises the question. The same question is raised by the psalmist. It's raised other places. And I think the fundamental answer to the question of how long, O Lord, or the fundamental answer to the question of what are you doing, God, what's going on here, doesn't come back to a detailed explanation. God doesn't, in virtually any case, virtually no case, does God decide to explain himself and decide to elaborate exactly what's going on. What God does, what he does in this book, what he does elsewhere, what God does is call us to an understanding of who he is, call us to an understanding of how he is active in life. And he doesn't necessarily answer specific questions. Certainly in this account, he doesn't give Habakkuk specific answers. He does tell him some very specific things, but I don't think he necessarily gives Habakkuk the answer to the question he seems to be asking here. How long, O Lord, will I call for help and you will not hear? I cry out to you violence and you do not save. Just a note about the word violence. It doesn't necessarily mean sort of a destructive physical force. That isn't necessarily just what he's talking about when he talks about violence. That's part of it. But when he talks about violence here, he's talking about wrongness, about things being out of kilter, things not being the way they're supposed to be, things not being settled in the way God intended them to be. That's what he's talking about when he says, I cry out to you violence. I cry out to you. Everything's wrong. Everything's out of place. Nothing's going the way it's supposed to. And yet you don't do anything about it, he says. Then he goes on and says, why do you make me to see iniquity? Why do you cause me to look on wickedness? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife exists and contention arises. Again, think of the historical context that we talked about a little bit earlier. In the society in Judah at that time, there's tremendous upheaval. There's the contrast of the reforms of Josiah a few years earlier with the chaos and with the idolatry and with the corruption that characterizes Jehoiakim's rule. And so there's all sorts of confusion that's going on. He goes on and he says, therefore the law is ignored and justice is never upheld. For the wicked surround the righteous, therefore justice comes out perverted. And you know that that is an apt description of what happens when a society is in chaos like that. You can't expect, in a chaotic society, a chaotic world like that, you can't expect there to be things that happen rightly, that things that that happen with justice and with equity and with fairness, because those aren't the principles that are governing what's going on in society at the time. And that's what Habakkuk is observing. He looks around him and he sees what's going on, and he naturally, for good reason, goes back and asks of God, why? What's going on here? Why is this happening? Now, I would suggest that Habakkuk, in asking the question, has his theology right in the sense that he's asking God the question, because he understands, I would suggest, he understands that it is in fact God who is in charge. It is in fact God who can do something about it. And so he rightly asks the question of God. And that's I think, a trap that that Christians sometimes fall into when they try to fix the blame for things going wrong, when they try to fix the blame somewhere other than a place that allows God to be who he is. And that obviously gets into some very sticky issues that are discussed here in a lot of different ways at a lot of different times. But I would suggest that Habakkuk sees clearly that he needs to go to God to ask that question. If there is anyone who knows what's going on, if there's anyone who can do something about what's going on, it's God. And Habakkuk doesn't think, doesn't act as though, doesn't talk as though what's going on is outside of God's control. He recognizes that he needs to go to God for answers to that question. Well, God does answer, starting in verse 5. God does answer, but he answers in a way that couldn't have been very pleasing to Habakkuk. He couldn't have been very, very happy with the answer. God, actually, when he starts off in verse 5, he starts off on a positive note. If I were Habakkuk listening to that, I'd be encouraged with the first God's first comment here. Verse 5, he says, "Look among the nations, observe, be astonished, wonder, because I'm doing something in your days you would not believe if you were told." So that sounds pretty good. I mean, that's got a positive tone to it. And then God tells him what's going to be happening here. He says, "For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that fierce and impetuous people who march throughout the earth to seize dwelling places which are not theirs." So understand what God is doing here in responding to Habakkuk. Habakkuk is saying, why is this going on? What's happening? And what God responds, the way God responds is by telling him not why it's happening, but by telling him what is going to happen next, that he is going to bring the Chaldeans in, that wicked people, that fierce and impetuous people that he's going to describe for us here in the next several verses. He's bringing the Chaldeans in to exact judgment against Judah. And you say, I don't want us to miss that point. It is against Judah. It's against their idolatry, their ungodliness, their unrighteousness, that God is bringing justice at that point. "I'm raising up the Chaldeans, that fierce and impetuous people who march throughout the earth to seize dwelling places that are not theirs." And then there's this unbelievable description of who the Chaldeans are. It says, "They are dreaded and feared. Their justice and authority originate with themselves." And that is perhaps the most succinct description of who the Chaldeans are, and we'll see the same idea reiterated a little bit later, and that is the Chaldeans are that people who see their authority, see their power, see their might coming from themselves rather than from God. So the Chaldeans are that people who basically have substituted themselves, put themselves in the place of God. They don't trust God. They don't believe God. They trust themselves. Their authority originates from themselves. They don't turn to anyone other than themselves. Their justice and authority originate with themselves in verse 7. Their horses are swifter than leopards and keener than wolves in the evening. There's a description of here of their unbelievable military might. And in fact, the Chaldeans swept through nation after nation after nation at this time. Nobody could effectively stand in their way during this period. Their horses are swifter than leopards, keener than wolves in the evening. Their horsemen come galloping. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle swooping down to devour. All of them come for violence. Their hordes of faces moves forward. They collect captives like sand. They mock at kings. Rulers are a laughing matter to them. They laugh at every fortress and heap up rubble to capture it. There's a description here of the absolutely unbelievable military might that the Chaldeans brought to bear against any nation that stood in their way. They laughed at the rulers who tried to stand against them. Their horsemen came in like eagles swooping down to devour. When they came across a fortified city, there are historical accounts of this military tactic they used. They would just heap up all sorts of rubble against the fortified city, against the wall, until they were able to breach the wall, until they were able to climb over the wall. And so it's a description of what went on militarily, or what was going to go on militarily with the Chaldeans. And again, understand, and we'll dwell on this here in another minute or two, what Habakkuk is seeing and hearing about from God is what is going to happen. Not what has happened already, but what is going to happen. It might have been a surprise for Habakkuk at this point to hear that it was the Chaldeans. The Assyrians, certainly he knew about, but it might have been, we don't know how exactly what time frame this was, what was known at this time, but it might have been a little bit of a surprise to him for it to be the Chaldeans that God is saying are going to come along and to overrun the nation. He goes on in verse 11, then they will sweep through like the wind and pass on. And again, there's a summary statement of what motivates the Chaldeans, how they view themselves, and there's an observation that God makes here for Habakkuk about how wrong this is in the end of verse 11 when it says, but they will be held guilty, they whose strength is their God. See, that's the fundamental problem with the Chaldeans. The fundamental thing that's at issue there is that their strength is their own God. Their authority, as we saw earlier, originates from them. That's the problem with the Chaldeans. They don't submit themselves to God. They don't seek to obey God. Rather, they consider themselves to be God. In their world, in the way they function, in the way they do things, there is no God other than their own authority, their own way of doing things. And God says to Habakkuk about them, they will be held guilty, he says. Then starting in verse 12, we have Habakkuk beginning to respond. He says, and he asks questions about God that show his confusion here, because God has said, I'm going to bring this horrible, corrupt people to bring judgment. And Habakkuk understandably asks, well, what is going on here? Why do you bring this people here to judge your people? There's some confusion there on Habakkuk's part, because the nation of Judah supposedly is God's chosen nation at this point, and yet he's bringing this ungodly people to come along and judge them. He starts off in verse 12 by making some observations about who God is, just some comments about who God is. Art thou not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? And I think that just in those two observations, I think that Habakkuk sort of captures, in some respects, the essence of who God is. When he talks about God being from everlasting, the more I study the scriptures, the more I look at the Old Testament, the more I look at the New Testament, the more I think that one of the most fundamental descriptions about who God is, one of the most fundamental characteristics of God is, I'm not sure how to put it, other than his beingness, the fact that he is. The fact that he has always been. That's the point of the title to Jack's book, The Most Real Being, is just that idea that the beingness of God, the reality of God, is what transcends everything else. All of human history, all of the reality that we see around us, it is the beingness, the existence of God that transcends that. And when the Old Testament writers refer to God being everlasting or refer to his timelessness, that's what they're getting at there. God is, always has been, always will be, stands above and outside the reality that that we have around us. I think that's what Habakkuk's pointing out here when he makes that comment, and then he builds on that by referring to God as my Holy One, because that's part and parcel of the whole thing. It isn't simply that God has always existed, always has been, always will be, but it's that God is holy. That's a critical part of the whole thing. And then he goes on and he makes the comment in verse 12. He says, O Lord my God, my Holy One, we will not die. Now, that's a little bit problematic because a lot of them did die. When the Chaldeans came sweeping through a little bit later, when Nebuchadnezzar came knocking on the door and when he carried off captives, and that's part of the historical context also, it is just a few short years after that that much of the nation of Judah, particularly the ruling elite, a lot of people from Judah were carried off into the Babylonian captivity as we know it. That's just a few short years after this account. And so when Habakkuk says we will not die, well, you gotta wonder, is he talking about physical death or what's he talking about here? And I think all he's doing is simply affirming his faith in God, affirming that regardless of what happens, he's trusting God for the outcome. So he says, we will not die, thou, and then he asks the question about what God's doing. He says, thou, O Lord, hast appointed them, the Chaldeans, to judge, and you, O rock, have established them to correct. But, he says, this is what's going through his mind, but your eyes are too pure to approve evil, and you can't look on wickedness with favor. So he's turning over in his mind. He's trying to sort through and trying to figure out, God, why, how and why are you using the Chaldeans? They're a wicked people. They're a people that you can't have favor with. Why are you using them in this judgment against the Jews in Judah? Why do you look with favor at the end of verse 13? Why do you look with favor on those who deal treacherously? Why are you silent when the wicked swallow up those who are more righteous than they? That's the question. When the Chaldeans come to sweep through Judah, to swallow them up, Habakkuk is saying, why are you doing that? Why do you look with favor on them and allow them to get away with this, even though we are more righteous? Now, at that point, Habakkuk had to know that the only sense in which they were more righteous was in the sense that they were God's chosen nation at that point. They were not more righteous, certainly, because of their behavior. We were told that that in fact the kings of Judah were more ungodly, more idolatrous, in fact, than the nations that they had dispossessed. And so it wasn't because of their behavior that they were considered righteous, as Habakkuk here points out here. It was simply because of their position in God's eyes, in God's plan, as he saw it. Then he goes on and is asking the questions about what's going on. Verse 14, why have you made men like the fish of the sea, like creeping things without a ruler over them? The Chaldeans bring all of them up with a hook and drag them away with their net and gather them together in their fishing net. Therefore, they rejoice and are glad. He's simply making observations about the way the Chaldeans, about what God has said about the Chaldeans and the way the Chaldeans are behaving towards other nations. They sweep through, they gather them up. The people are directionless like fish, and the Chaldeans just sweep them all up with a hook, with a net. Gather them together, and the Chaldeans then rejoice and are glad. And then he makes the same kind of point that he had made earlier about the Chaldeans whose strength is their God, the Chaldeans whose authority and justice originate with themselves. In verse 16, he makes the same sort of point when he says, therefore they, the Chaldeans, offer a sacrifice to their net and burn incense to their fishing net, because through these things their catch is large. So rather than acknowledging God, and rather than acknowledging what God is doing, and worshiping God, that's obviously just symbolic. When it talks about offering sacrifice to their net and burning incense to their fishing net, I'm sure that wasn't literally the case. The point Habakkuk is making is that they see their power, they see their success coming from their own efforts, from their own implements, their own tools, from the things that they do. So rather than being thankful to God and worshiping God, they're thankful to their own efforts and to their own tools. Therefore, up then down to verse 17, will they therefore empty their net and continually slay nations without sparing? So Habakkuk is speaking with some despair about what is going to be happening with the Chaldeans. And God then, then chapter 2, verse 1, he then makes Habakkuk, gives a response that is a great picture of the response of faith that God is going to talk about a little bit later when he says the righteous man shall live by faith. In chapter 2, verse 1, Habakkuk, after talking about the chaos that the nation is already in, after talking about the utter chaos that will happen when the Chaldeans come sweeping through and the horrors of having the Chaldeans come sweeping through, then Habakkuk makes this comment in verse 1 of chapter 2. He says, I will stand on my guard post and station myself on the rampart, and I will keep watch to see what he will speak to me and how I may reply when I am reproved. So what Habakkuk is saying is, in spite of everything that's going on, in spite of all the chaos and upheaval, his response is to keep watch and wait for and expect to see happen what God has said is going to happen. Now make no mistake, it's a horrible thing that is going to happen. God has just given Habakkuk some terrible news. Would have been a lot nicer if he had said another king is coming like Josiah, who's going to straighten things out in the nation of Judah. That would have been a much better message, but that wasn't the message. The Chaldeans are coming. They're going to sweep through. They're going to destroy everything in their path. They are going to be the thing that God uses to judge the nation of Judah. And Habakkuk's response to that in 2 verse 1 is, I'll stand on the rampart and watch and wait to see what happens, so that when it happens, I'll be able to respond to you, God. I'll be able to acknowledge what you're doing. Well, then God responds, and here we're just going to get a couple more verses into this, and then we'll close for questions. But God's response here sets the stage for the rest of chapter 2, when he now makes some observations about the Chaldeans. And he makes some observations, I believe, about how God is responding to and dealing with the Chaldeans. In chapter 2, verse 1, it says, then the Lord answered me and said, record the vision. That's this whole account that we have here. It starts off the oracle which Habakkuk the prophet saw. That's what this whole account is. It's the vision that God had given to Habakkuk, the picture that he had given to him about what was going to happen. And God says to Habakkuk, record the vision and inscribe it on tablets. And the reason, I think it's there's a reason why he's very specific like that, is because he wants the Chaldeans, when they come sweeping through in a few short years, he wants them to see that God has been waiting for them. See, he didn't say to Habakkuk at this point, stand on the rampart and proclaim to the people of Judah what God's doing. Rather, he says, record the vision, write it down on tablets, write it down in a form that will be permanent or relatively permanent, a form that will survive through fire and through warfare and through all of the chaos that goes along with it. Write down the vision, write it down on tablets. Why? So that, at the end of verse 2, so that the one who reads it may run. See, I think what God has in mind here, the reason he is telling Habakkuk to write it down, is because he desires a response from the Chaldeans. The rest of chapter 4, what we're going to talk about next week, is a series of woes to the Chaldeans, where God describes the Chaldeans, describes them in some detail. And I think the expectation, the hope there, is that the Chaldeans will see themselves in that description. And the desire that God has is that the one who reads this account will in fact respond. Now when he says that the one who reads it may run, I don't think that what he's that God's desired outcome necessarily is the military defeat of the Chaldeans. I think when he talks about that the one who reads it may run, what he's asking for is a change of heart, is a change of attitude on the part of the Chaldeans here. And then he goes on in verse 3, he says, "For the vision is yet for the appointed time." What I'm talking about here, he tells Habakkuk, hasn't happened yet. It's coming down the road. The vision is yet for the appointed time. It hastens toward the goal, and it will not fail. And then he encourages, God is speaking there of his own faithfulness. He's put himself on the line here. In saying this to Habakkuk, he's put himself on the line because he's described Habakkuk in some detail what's going to happen. The Chaldeans are coming. Well, if it was the Egyptians that came, or if it was somebody else, there'd be a problem there. But God has been very specific in telling him what's going to happen and telling him, wait for it. The time is coming. And then he's got a word, again, I think here in verse 4 for the Chaldeans. He says, "Behold, as for the proud one." And you don't get a description of a people more proud than the Chaldeans in this passage. The Chaldeans are the proud ones whose strength is their God, it says, whose authority and justice originates with them, who offer sacrifices to their own tools, to their own abilities. The Chaldeans are you couldn't describe a people as being any more proud than the Chaldeans in this passage. And God's observation here for the Chaldeans, I believe for the Chaldeans, as for the proud man, his soul is not right within him. And that's the message of the gospel, if you will, that I maybe shouldn't use that quite that way in the Old Testament context, but that's the message, the call to repentance, the request for a change of heart and a change of direction that God is issuing, I believe, to the Chaldeans. His soul is not right within him. He wants them to recognize and to acknowledge that. And that's why in the rest of the chapter, he will be going into a detailed list of ways in which their soul is not right within them. And then we get to those words that we see in the New Testament in those three places. As for the proud one, his soul is not right within him. But, he says, the righteous man or the righteous will live by his faith. And there you have an unbelievably stark contrast that God is painting here for Habakkuk and asking Habakkuk to record. You have those two choices. You have the proud man whose heart is not right within him, whose God is his own strength, whose justice and authority originate with him. And on the other hand, you have the righteous who lives by faith, who lives by an acknowledgement of who God is, the everlasting God, the holy God, the one who has always been, the one whose being and existence transcends all of our understanding, all of our reality as we know it. And that's the contrast that God wants to paint for Habakkuk here that I believe he wants the Chaldeans to see as well. Well, next week, as I said, we're going to continue in chapter 2. We're going to be talking about there are a series of four or five woes to the Chaldeans where God describes the Chaldeans in more detail, what they're like, how they do things, how they function. And then in chapter 3, there is Habakkuk's prayer in response to all of this, in response to the message, in response to what God is doing, has been doing, will be doing. We have Habakkuk's prayer in chapter 3. So next week we're going to pick up again at this point, look at this further description of the Chaldeans, and then look at Habakkuk's response. We've got just a couple minutes for questions. If anybody has any questions or observations, comments, we got a couple minutes. Do we have a microphone?
Hey, owe you all an apology for starting off today's worship with a recitation of Modern Major General. It wasn't appropriate, and I own it. I apologize. I won't do it again. Thank you.
Hey, anybody, any questions about Habakkuk?
Do you think he's saying there's essentially no difference between the character of the Chaldeans and the character of Judah at this point?
I would say certainly. I mean, if anything, I would say that the character of Judah, if anything, is worse than the character of the Chaldeans, because they are the ones who, you get to Paul's argument in Romans, what benefit is there to being a Jew? Well, there's a lot of benefit. You have the oracles of God. You have all these other things. Well, the Jews had those things, the Jews in Judah. We had seen them just a few short years before. We had seen them as a nation responding well, and now they're back off track again, led by the king at the time, but the people, I'm sure, share some of the blame as well. But I think the nation of Judah was certainly no better than the Chaldeans at that time. Anybody else?
In my Bible, when it starts off with the oracle, which Habakkuk the prophet saw, there's a little footnote that oracle means burden, and haven't thought of it that way before. I'm thinking of the Greek oracles. Is that a common thinking of an oracle at that time? Because all the cultures have them. Or does Israel have a very different way of viewing an oracle?
Well, when I looked at that word, and I'm not a Hebrew expert by any stretch of the imagination, but when I looked at the word, the way it was used, burden, I think, in the sense of a burdenous message that God desires to be communicated to the people. So in that sense, yeah, I think it is used in that sense in the Old Testament, and isn't an inappropriate. It's a little bit unfamiliar to us to use that word if it had been translated that way, but I think that's the sense of it there. Anybody else? Okay, well, with that, we're done, and we'll see you next week.